Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and now we continue our series Democracy Debrief, where we dig into some of the electoral process underpinnings that we often take for granted that were relevant to this year's election. Today, redistricting and gerrymandering. Democrats say the Republican grip on the House of Representatives and on so many state houses nationwide is based on the party's fantastic success in gerrymandering, drawing district lines that give them a share of Congress, for example, greater than the percentage of voters nationwide who actually vote for Republicans for Congress. But others point to geographic sorting, where Democrats cluster in neighborhoods with their fellow Democrats and Republicans with fellow Republicans more than they used to. With me now to dig into this are Joey Chen, professor of political science at the University of Michigan, and Dave Weigel, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. And we don't have Dave Weigel yet. So, Professor Chen, welcome to WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Why do we do this? Why do we redraw the lines at all every decade after the census rather than just make a permanent map that kind of chops the nation, you know, geographically into the number of House seats?
Well, one of the great things about our country is that we have significant rapid demographic change. That means that population moves and often grows in states like Florida and Texas and California. Lots of states around the country have population changes, demographic changes, and we've got to account for these in districting. We've got to make our districts equally populated, and that means apportioning, for example, U.S. House seats across states in a relatively equal way. So that's why we do have to do redistricting every decade.
The word gerrymandering has a kind of dirty connotation, like a sort of, you know, unfair drawing of the district lines to unfairly benefit one political actor or another. What's gerrymandering and where did that really come from?
Well, gerrymandering is a practice that is not entirely unique to the U.S., but is relatively rare around the world, but in the U.S. we've practiced it for centuries. Gerrymandering is essentially the partisan manipulation of the drawing of the geographic boundaries of a district, usually for a partisan end, but partisan ends can take a number of different forms. It could mean trying to make your seat safer for your incumbents. It could mean trying to maximize the number of Democrats or Republicans that control Congress or control your state legislature. But basically, it's the partisan manipulation of geographic boundaries of your districts.
And is that – and Dave Weigel also joins us now, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Dave.
Hey.
So let me pick up right there with you. Is gerrymandering something that the public should try to wipe out, or is gerrymandering just kind of a smear for politics as usual, and whoever happens to get control of the state houses after the 2010 election, 2020 election, you know, after the census is done each decade, gets to draw the lines the way they want?
I think it's completely of a piece with the reasons people don't like politics. It's a very coherent argument made by mostly conservatives that we should have term limits for politicians because politicians don't deserve to stay in office forever. You can make a pretty quick logical leap from that to politicians should not be able to decide which electorates decide to send them back to office or not. That's what gerrymandering's turned into. It wasn't always like this. Sorry for the communication snafu in the beginning. If this point was made and I missed it, I apologize. But 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you didn't have the sophistication of information to determine what kind of district would elect the maximal number of your party members. You have since 2000, especially since the 2010 gerrymander. I'd point to Robert Draper's work covering the North Carolina gerrymander. There is data crunching you can do that tells you not just how to elect the most members of your party, but how to make sure you don't accidentally create districts that might turn to the other party in the next 10 years. And I don't see why that is any more helpful to democracy than letting people staying in office forever because there are no term limits. So I think it's when voters have been able to make a clear choice on this, when it's not distorted by a kind of misleading campaign, they usually go against the gerrymander and try to throw the situation to judges. When they do that in Iowa and California, then you end up with more competitive districts. You end up with almost no competitive districts in states that are gerrymandered.
How out of whack are the seats in the House now? In other words, the number that I've read is that there were 3 million more Americans who voted for Republicans for the House this year than who voted for Democrats. That hasn't always been the case. I think in 2012, more Americans voted for Democrats for the House altogether, and yet there were still a lot more Republicans elected to the House than Democrats. But this year, 3 million more Americans voted for Republicans for the House. How out of whack is the proportion of Republicans to Democrats in the House than the actual vote? Professor Chen?
Well, this is the very question I've done a lot of research on. And the way I study it is by studying redistricting in a scientific way using computer simulations. So what I'm trying to ask in my research is, how would these districts have looked, and therefore how would the partisan composition of the U.S. House have looked if we didn't have any partisan gerrymandering in any of these states, whether they're Republican-controlled or Democratic-controlled states? And an important thing to remember is that both Republicans and Democrats are engaging in gerrymandering. It's just that in recent years, Republicans have probably controlled more state legislatures and have done more partisan gerrymandering as a result. But here's what I found in doing these computer simulations where I'm drawing districts that are just drawn to maximize geographic compactness, to keep counties, municipalities intact as much as possible, to follow traditional redistricting criteria. So to give you an idea of what I found, let's think about the November 2014 election. That was an election in which the GOP won 53% of the two-party vote nationwide. So it was a reasonably pro-Republican year. Now, 2014, Republicans won 247 House seats, huge majority. So if we didn't have partisan gerrymandering, the Republicans would have won a net total across all the states of about 245. Rather than 247 House seats. So the net aggregate effect of partisan gerrymandering was to increase Republican control of the House by about two seats. That doesn't sound like a whole lot. And the reason it doesn't sound like a whole lot is because there are states like Maryland, like Illinois, that are also doing Democratic-controlled gerrymandering that's counteracting some of this Republican gerrymandering that's going on in states like Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan. So gerrymandering definitely has quite a bit of an effect at an individual state level in a lot of these different states, those states that I just mentioned. But the net aggregate effect of both parties doing gerrymandering cancels each other out to some degree. Now, it's still a pro-Republican effect. It's just a relatively small one.
It sounds then, Dave Weigel, like this is something we should be more concerned about for state legislatures where, you know, the state-by-state control, if it's Democratic gerrymandering or Republican gerrymandering, is going to really tip the scales of who gets represented how within each state. But with respect to Congress, at least the way Professor Chen describes it, it's kind of a wash.
Not quite a while. I'm glad you put it that way. It is a bigger issue for state legislatures simply because people don't pay as much attention to who they elect to state legislatures. One of the paradoxes of democracy is the closer government is to you, unless there's some kind of major scandal, the less you know about who represents you. The further away, like the president, the more you know about that person. And so from this election, you have cases like Minnesota, I should point to North Carolina first. North Carolina, where there was a fairly close presidential election, there was a fairly close Senate race, there was a governor's race and some down ballot races Democrats won, but voters didn't move the ball at all in the state legislature because they couldn't really. There were a lot of African American voters packed into safe districts, and there were suburbanites split across districts drawn to elect Republicans. Wisconsin, where a lawsuit has advanced past that state Supreme Court, is another example of this. Very close election. In 2014 and 2012, Democrats actually carried the vote for state assembly, but Republicans in those years won the state assembly. In 2016, fairly close election, they gained seats in part because of these the ways the suburbs were carved up. And that has led to a situation where, let's say, a really great election for Democrats happens in 2018, they elect a bunch of governors. They're still going to have to draw maps with Republican legislatures that maybe most of the electorate wanted to vote against but wasn't able to unelect because of what districts they're drawn into.
Let's take a phone call. And here's Arturo in Colts Neck, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Arturo.
Hello. I just have a short comment, and that's that gerrymandering should be called what it is, what I think it is. It's a corruption of democracy, regardless of what party does it.
Thank you very much. And that's a conclusion that you can both agree with, I presume. Professor Chen, is it a corruption of democracy?
Yeah, kind of the sentiment that Arturo is getting at and what David just talked about a minute ago is absolutely right. It's something that lots of people agree on, which is that if, you know, even though I'm saying in the aggregate that gerrymandering has a relatively small effect on the composition, partisan composition of the U.S. House as a whole, state by state, there are a lot of asymmetries between voters and their elected congressional delegations, as well as their elected state legislators. And that's what we see as this perversion of democracy. It seems like if even though there is a nationwide balance of Republicans and Democrats gerrymandering, that at the individual state level, it seems quite wrong that, for example, North Carolina has 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats representing North Carolina in the state delegation. Is that really what the voters of North Carolina are telling us they want when North Carolina is a relatively balanced state in terms of overall partisanship statewide?
By the way, here's a clip for historical interest. The late former New York City Mayor Ed Koch, one of the last things he did before he passed away was advocate a plan for nonpartisan redistricting in New York State. This was in 2011. And he got a lot of lawmakers who were running for office in 2010 or just after they were elected to office to sign a pledge that they would reform the redistricting process in New York State. And he was particularly concerned not so much about members of Congress but the state legislature, which Mayor Koch saw as highly gerrymandered. Here's 40 seconds of him on this show in March of 2011.
New York, unlike any other state in the union, so far as I know, has the lowest turnover rate. It's an impossible rate to accept. Less than 3% of the people who run for re-election are defeated. That's not democracy, mm-hmm. And it isn't because they're loved and have done a terrific job. It is because in the Senate they work the district so it looks like a salamander, which is where they got the name gerrymander, in order to get all the Republicans in and all the Democrats out. And conversely, they do the same in the Assembly.
Mayor Koch, not that long before he passed away, in March of 2011, on his final crusade to get nonpartisan redistricting instituted in New York State. And you know what, Dave Weigel? They went back on their promise. A lot of the elected officials in the New York State Legislature who signed that pledge for Mayor Koch then reneged on it. And there are all kinds of theories as to what political deals they made and traded away for what interests. But they never did enact nonpartisan redistricting in New York. Is that a good example of the resistance to it?
That's a very good example. I think Ohio's case in 2012 was an interesting example, too, because voters succeeded in getting a ballot measure on redistricting, and a coalition of interest branded it as a way to protect politicians. You know, basically, what I find revealing in politics from any situation is if the argument used to defeat something is basically the argument for it. if you have to hoodwink people in that sense, usually the way people campaign against gerrymandering is claim it'll be a power grab for somebody, when obviously gerrymandering is a power grab for whatever party was able to spend the most and win in a census year. And so that New York example is great. New York has, two things here. New York's unusually unaccountable, where you have legislators who keep going to jail and voters are unable to unelect them, even to the extent where when Democrats win more Senate seats, a coalition will form in Albany, making sure the Republicans run the state Senate and stop this sort of reform legislation. But you could expand this to the whole map. This was allegedly a change election in 2016 where people voted for a non-politician and rejected the incumbent party, except almost every incumbent, more than 90% of incumbents won. I think had people been able to choose more evenly, like they were in Senate races and like they were at the presidential level, they might have chosen something else. But there's this disconnect between what people say they want in terms of government accountability and the accountability they're allowed to vote for because of the mapping.
How much do you agree with that, Professor Chen?
That's basically right. One of the problems is that the national media is very good at covering events that happened very recently, at covering current events. And the problem is that redistricting, in principle, happens once every 10 years. It happened in 2012. And so we're not so good at keeping voters' attention on these sorts of issues during the intervening 10 years between redistricting cycles, between redistricting in 2012 and 2022. It's something that voters don't think about all the time as much as right now they're thinking about, for example, Donald Trump's cabinet appointments. And so that's something that if you have to have voters putting pressure on their elected officials to actually have successful reform efforts.
Pat in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling because the issues with gerrymandering and redistricting never brings up the fact that the House itself hasn't been expanded since the 1913 change, which was after the 1910 census. But after the 1920 census, we just stopped, and we've had the same number of representatives since then.
Which means that each representative has more people in their district.
Which allows more room to play around with the gerrymandering.
Does it? Professor Chen, let me go to you on this. Do you think that's that there's greater risk of gerrymandering the more people are in a district?
It's such a fascinating question and a fascinating way to look at redistricting because this is fundamentally a geography problem. Right now, a congressional district has an average population nationwide of about 700,000 people. That's obviously much larger than it was 100 years ago, much larger than it was 200 years ago. Now, who does that affect? Well, when you look at political geography, look at the geography, how voters are clustered. Up and down East Coast states, Democrats tend to be clustered in a relatively small number of very large urban areas, places like Charlotte, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore. These are places that are heavy, heavy Democratic strongholds. And with the current size of congressional districts, it means that systematically in these states, especially in these East Coast industrialized states, Democrats have a disadvantage when it comes to redistricting with a population size of 700,000 in each district. If districts were smaller, we'd actually get closer and closer to what some would call proportional representation, meaning that if North Carolina has a 50-50 Republican and Democratic split, then Democrats and Republicans would win approximately 50-50 of 50% of the seats each. So the smaller that districts are, the closer you get to that kind of proportional representation. What we have right now with an average district size of about 700,000 in each congressional district is quite a bit away from that sort of proportional representation benchmark or proportional representation ideal. So the smaller you make districts, in other words, if you increase the number of U.S. House districts in Congress, you would get closer to a proportional representation in a lot of these East Coast states.
That's so interesting. So as we start to run out of time, Dave Weigel, do you think this should be taken up, this which almost nobody ever thinks about, as a rallying cry for a better democracy, kind of like opponents of the Electoral College or for, you know, the National Popular Vote movement or the Compact movement with respect to that, to expand the number of people in the House of Representatives, because then we'd get closer to what we might have had 100 years ago when the total population of the country was smaller, a more proportional representation of the population in Congress?
I don't think that is a very promising cause for simply the reason that at a time when most people hate Congress, it's a non-starter to say, let's expand the number of people we elect, even though it makes intuitive sense. I don't think it would work. I think more likely you start with explain why gerrymandering is a problem for the same reasons people think endlessly reelected incumbents are a problem. Start with that because that makes more sense. I just wanted to make the point, kind of undergirding what we were talking about here. We're talking about how the clustering of Democrats, and I'm not saying that the professor is trying to say that this has always been a problem, but when we discuss this, we almost get ourselves in the mindset of thinking, well, of course, Democrats are in cities and Republicans are in the rural areas. That's fairly recent. The real worry, I think, here undergirding all of this is that we're moving into for now, a politics where one party is cosmopolitan and non-white that gets maybe 38% of the white vote. One party is rural and mostly white and basically toxic in urban areas, only has a couple of big city mayors. And the electoral system right now is geared towards helping the party of rural areas in terms of, you know, electoral college preferencing rural states, gerrymandering preferencing rural areas over the cities. There's kind of a virtue assigned to that sort of politics and a virtue taken away from urban politics. Right now, the conversation is the, you know, party that won 48% of the vote doesn't understand the real America, where the party that won 46% of the vote does. And I don't think that's very tenable. Maybe some of the solution here is Democrats figuring out ways to appeal some of the voters they lost. But this is a new situation. We've never had a Democratic Party shaped like this, the way that, you know, the socialist parties in Europe generally kind of have this makeup. Plus some rural voters. We've never had an urban party and a rural party, and that is exposing how much things are slanted towards helping the party that gets the most rural white votes. That is a problem. I think it's even less fixable than gerrymandering for the time being. But that's something that's going to be coloring our politics for the next few years.
Dave Weigel, national politics reporter for the Washington Post. And Joey Chan, professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, nearly 30 years after the end of the Cold War, why isn't liberal democracy more entrenched around the world? Stay with us.